You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Because Psalm 104 is all about celebrating God for making and sustaining the created world, it's what's called a hymn of praise, and it's not dissimilar from other ancient creation hymns from the Near East, from Egypt's hymn to Aten or Mesopotamian hymns to the sun and storm gods. Seems people have always marveled at the natural world and seen something sacred holding it all together. But where some traditions saw creation as the result of cosmic battles or divine power struggles, our psalm sees something different. A world created and sustained by wisdom and care. In fact, the psalmist portrays the natural world as the visible, awe-inspiring clothing of divine wisdom. The heavens stretched out like a tent, clouds like a chariot, springs flowing, animals drinking, and crops growing. It's poetry describing the reliability of a world that works. And for most of human history, we've taken that dependability for granted, living as if the world would just keep on working, no matter what. But looking around today, one wonders if the psalmist would still be so confident.
Our words of wisdom are selections from Psalms 104.
Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty, wrapped in light as with a garment.
You stretch out the heavens like a tent. You set the earth on its foundations. O Lord, how manifold are your works.
In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures.
When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground.
May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in God's works. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have being.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Once upon a time, a little girl crawled up into her great-grandmother's lap and, looking up into her great-grandmother's face, saw all those crevices, lines, and wrinkles. Then she felt her own smooth, baby-like skin, and she said to her great-grandmother, "Did God make you?" Her great-grandmother said, "Yes, honey, God made me." Then the little girl said, "Well, great-grandmother, did God make me?" Her great-grandmother said, Oh, yes, God made you too." Then the little girl asked, "Well, great-grandmother, don't you think God's doing a lot better job these days?" We laugh at that kind of naivete, but the truth is, we still don't fully understand how the world works. And maybe more importantly, we're only just beginning to understand how thoroughly we can disrupt it. But one thing we can know, if we just pay attention, is that all through the Bible, we're reminded of the interconnectedness, not the separateness, of humanity and the earth. Starting in Genesis, the Hebrew words for humanity, Adam, and ground, Adama, express poetically the deep relationship that we have with the earth. We are earth creatures, dust with breath. And the more we discover about our environment, what's in it and how it works and our effects on it, the more we see the depth of that interconnectedness, something our mystics and poets have always sensed. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuit order, saw it clearly. He encouraged his followers to see God in all things and all things in God, reminding us that the spiritual life is enhanced by paying attention to the world around us. Emily Dickinson said, "The one commandment I've never broken is, consider the lilies of the field." Going beyond a sort of sentimental stop and smell the roses connotation, Dickinson was on about a sense of awareness that cultivated awe. John Steinbeck casts the net even further, writing, "Most of the feelings we call religious, most of the mystical outcrying, which is one of the most prized and desired reactions of our species, is really the understanding and the attempt to say that human beings are related to the whole thing, related inextricably to all reality, known and unknowable. All things are one thing, and that one thing is all things. Plankton, a shimmering phosphorescence on the sea, and the spinning planets and an expanding universe, all bound together. It is advisable to look from the tide pool to the stars, and then back to the tide pool again. The deepest spirituality is rooted in awareness and awe, seeing God in all things and all things in God. Being awestruck implies a sudden experience of mystery, an awareness of beauty and power that transcends our ability to comprehend. Such an encounter pleads for a response, first gratitude, then responsibility. Consider, and then be considerate. Our psalm today proclaims, "How manifold are your works, O God! In wisdom you have made them all." The psalmist marvels not only in the variety and numbers of creatures, but also the tender care of the Creator. "You make springs to gush forth, giving drink to every animal. You cause grass to grow for the cattle and plants for people to use, to bring forth food from the earth and wine to gladden the human heart. May the glory of the Lord endure forever." And yet, we live in a world where that glory may not endure forever. In fact, since the first Earth Day 56 years ago, things have become decidedly more uncertain. Despite all the evidence of human-caused climate change, and despite the alarm being raised by the overwhelming majority of climate scientists, many people's awareness has resisted being heightened. It doesn't help when you have authorities like Senator James Inhofe standing on the Senate floor declaring that global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. And sadly, Christians don't have the greatest reputation on the topic either. Christians who believe in the rapture heresy, running red hot right now with the war in Iran, say, "We don't have to worry about the earth. God is going to destroy it and start all over when Jesus comes again." And trust me, there is not a lot you can do to convince people otherwise if that's where they're coming from. I've tried. But for those of us living in the reality-based community, we aren't talking about vague environmental what-ifs. Extreme heat is becoming the deadliest weather event in the United States. Wildfires are turning entire regions into seasonal hazard zones. Floods and storms are displacing families not once, but repeatedly. Insurance companies are quietly withdrawing from high-risk areas because the numbers no longer add up. All the while, solutions like wind turbines are being maligned as a diabolical scheme to spread cancer. And yet, astonishingly, we are still having debates about whether this is even happening. Under the current administration, the EPA's authority has been decimated, and incentives promoting renewable energy have been canceled. All the while, the fossil fuel industry continues to receive generous subsidies from U.S. taxpayers. At the very moment urgent solutions are required, many are choosing, for the sake of short-term gain, to plunder every resource possible while nobody's looking. Right here in Arizona, the Saudi Arabian government was sold nearly 15 square miles of La Paz County farmland to grow alfalfa to feed cattle in the Middle East. Why? Because alfalfa is so water-intensive to grow, it's been made illegal to grow in Saudi Arabia. So they come here, where lax water rules allow them to drain our ancient groundwater reserves for export in the form of alfalfa. At first, there were no restrictions, despite the wells of American farmers drying up. There have been some limits placed in recent years, but nowhere near what is necessary to take into consideration the preciousness of water in the Arizona desert. That's why Dr. Robert K. Musil, professor of global environmental politics at American University, says, "The biblical texts we need for this journey are not only those about the goodness of God's creation, the lilies of the field, the coming of rain in the desert. The essential texts describe Jesus' ministry, his call to heal, to bring hope to suffering humanity, to do justice, to bring peace to those, especially the most vulnerable, who are in danger." And faced with the greed and financial resources of multinational corporations and voracious resource-hungry governments, the whole planet is at the top of that vulnerable list. We now know that environmental conditions, polluted air, unsafe water, rising heat, contribute to the deaths of millions of children every year from asthma, dysentery, cholera, malaria, and more. All are exacerbated by poverty, by war, and increasingly by the warming and disruption of our global climate. Rising temperatures lead to the spread of disease-carrying mosquitoes. Warming waters, drinking water fouled by floods, runoff from heavy rains or hurricanes, all bring bacteria that in the belly of a poor, malnourished baby doesn't mean just diarrhea, but death. From studies by Philippe Grandjean, we know that a single molecule of mercury or PCBs released into the environment can make its way through evaporation, rain, and the food chain from a broken electric generator in Texas all the way to the Arctic. There, it enters the bloodstream of an Inuit mother eating fish, crosses the placenta, and harms the learning and development of her beloved child. Not hypothetically, not someday, right now, every year. And now, because of the fundamentalist Christian worldview, partisan political decisions, ideological agendas, and short-sighted leadership, millions more are now at risk. Many of the tragic deaths we're told are inevitable, we could actually still prevent. For decades, the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, has built clean water and sanitation systems so children don't die from diarrhea, has distributed insecticide-treated bed nets so families are protected from mosquito-borne disease, has supported maternal child health programs that treat pneumonia and malnutrition before they become fatal, and has helped communities adapt to drought and extreme weather. millions of children are alive today because we decided to act. Because we as a country, through USAID, had the will to do what we know works. But tomorrow, millions have been condemned to an uncertain future because of greed and short-sightedness. But you might ask, didn't Jesus say, inasmuch as you have done it to the billionaires and the tech bros, you have done it to me? Uh-huh. And yet, some Christians still hold on to the idea that none of this really matters. That any moment now, God will sweep in, wrap things up, and start over. And that reinforces the idea that the world is disposable. So why bother caring for it? But our text today doesn't describe a disposable world. It describes a sustainable world, a cherished environment, all of creation interconnected. And if we take that notion seriously, then we have to face the reality that we can't afford to be bystanders. Psalm 104 suggests that creation is worthy of awe, enough awe to inspire a sense of responsibility for its care. You know, author, priest, and Christian mystic Matthew Fox is on to something good because he was silenced by Joseph Ratzinger, head of the Roman Catholic Inquisition back in 1989. You can also check out the two Sundays back in 2021 when Fox preached here at the Fountains. We'll put a link in this video's description. Fox has suggested that a polluted Mother Earth is a metaphor for the crucified and resurrected Jesus. Innocent of any crime, she has blessed us for billions of years and is now being killed by pollution. Even so, she rises daily to redeem us, holding out hope for a radical change in the human heart and spirit. And that radical change requires action on our part. Not just the recycling of an occasional soda can. On this Earth Day, we are reminded as Christians that we are obliged to speak and act on behalf of the environment. And the problem isn't that we don't know what's happening. The problem is that we don't want to fully face what it means. It's easier to hope someone else will handle it. But hope, real hope, is not passive. Hope is not optimism. And apparently, hoping everything just works out is not very sound environmental policy. Hope is action. And Greta Thunberg reminds us, I want you to act as if the house is on fire, because it is. Friends, every generation makes a decision about the future. Some build it, some consume it, and some borrow from it with such gluttony, there's nothing left to pass on. And we are dangerously close to being that generation. Not because we didn't know, but because we delayed, we hesitated, we convinced ourselves that small gestures were enough. And truth be told, tomorrow isn't something we're guaranteed anymore. It's something we're either making possible or making impossible. Primatologist Jane Goodall makes it clear. What you do makes a difference, and you have to decide what kind of difference you want to make. Are we willing to raise the alarm, make the demands, and live in such a way that there is still a tomorrow left to give? Remembering that one day someone will look back at this moment and ask, they knew, right? And the answer will be, yes, they knew. As the first generation to know we're losing tomorrow, what will you do with what you know? What will you do with this last chance to give the gift of a tomorrow? May each of us do our part to honor, celebrate, and preserve the wonders of creation. Be well. Okay, if you're willing to take the challenge to do your part seriously, you don't have to figure out what to do on your own. Here are three resources that you can check out right now to take action. If you're looking for practical, faith-based ways to respond, check out Creation Justice Ministries, a DC-based network of 37 denominations helping people turn belief into practical action, both locally and nationally. If you're here in Arizona or want to support local efforts, get behind the work of Arizona Interfaith Power and Light. They're creating real opportunities to show up, advocate, and make a difference right where we live, including this week's Earth Day vigil at the state capitol. And if you want to go deeper into both the science and the spiritual foundations for urgent climate action, you can explore Living the Questions series with Reverend Michael Dowd, Pro-Future Faith, The Prodigal Species Comes Home, available in both DVD and streaming formats for home use or in your local faith community. The links to all are in the description. In the final analysis, this isn't about which resource you choose. It's about whether you choose anything at all. And especially with the distractions of all the political and global chaos at the moment, don't let this obligation slip between the cracks. Because part of being a follower of Jesus today is acting like you know you've been entrusted with the gift of a tomorrow. Hey, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.